So we're just going to kind of walk through a bit of a timeline. And here's what I'm going to do. So actually, I want to start with the day of our arrest, and then I want to back up and just turn the clock backwards and journey through a couple of weeks, about a week and a half, that led up to the day of the arrest this evening. So that's what this is, a multiple evening story. How can you tell a month-long story in a 45 minutes? So that's what we're aiming at, Steve, 45 minutes.
Good luck with that.
Good luck with that. So basically what we're doing right now is, in the actual calendar days, we're in jail 10 years ago. And for 3 weeks, essentially. It's a little shy of 3 weeks total, but 3 weeks, three Sundays, three weekends, we are in a Haitian jail together with two other men, some of you have met both of the other two that were with us, Drew Colberth, Renee's youngest brother, and then Jim Allen, or Jim Wyatt, as I know him, a cousin of mine from Amarillo, Texas, who, by the way, is the designer of this pulpit. That's a story of a whole nother day. I can tell that came since these days in jail, and probably through lots of conversations we had. We had a lot of time for conversation, didn't we? Mm-hmm. and we did. So before we say much, I wonder if anyone here remembers. I mean, 10 years ago at one level is a long time ago. And, you know, we think about the things that touch us closely. It means nearly every one of us who are born prior to 2001, September 11, 2001, you'll know where you were. You'll know what was happening in your life. You'll know how old your children were. You'll know what you were doing at that hour or that moment. Some of you are old enough to remember exactly, precisely where you were when John F. Kennedy was shot, assassinated. You might even be able to attach Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination to a particular moment in time or what have you. But I wonder, before we share anything, is anyone willing to just give us a short synopsis of where were you when you heard the news that we were that we had been arrested? It'll seem awkward for you to have to do this, but we'll need you to go to a microphone so that in the chance that someone's able to listen online, either tonight or archaeologically archived, will be archaeological as well, but archived, that we'll be able to hear those questions or those statements that you have. So let's take a few moments. And of course, some of you weren't even here. You knew nothing about us. And so some of what you're about to hear tonight and the next couple of Sunday nights will be brand new information for you. And so, does anyone remember, where were you? What was going on? Where did you first hear the news? We had been arrested. Ellen? Just go for it. That mic, you can tip it down or take it out or just break it. Something, whatever. You'll be fine. Get real close to it.
I was sitting at the computer in my living room when I got a call from Paul Rodriguez. Most of you know who Paul Rodriguez is. And he told me that they were in jail, so I didn't know what to think, because John had gone down there, so I didn't know. I thought he was in the Dominican Republic, which he was, so he didn't get put in jail with the rest of them, which is probably a real good thing at his age. I think that would have been bad if he had been put in jail. So then I went over to Dobson's because I didn't want to be there by myself. I had all these things going through my head, but somehow I knew everyone was going to get out and they were going to be safe. I just knew that. And I thought, well, an angel came and let the other guys out. But if an angel came and opened the gate, our pastor would make everybody stay there because that would be the right thing to do. So, that didn't happen, of course. But I believe God was in getting them out of there. I really do. And it is something that you do remember. That you remember this. You don't forget about it. You remember Silas coming home all bit up by mosquitoes. I mean, it was bad. But and Steve, not because he bragged about something. I don't know. I did something. I remember how worried my nephew Art was about Steve McMullen being in jail. And I told you that before. Art was very worried about Steve. So I'm glad they're here, and I'm glad it's done, and I'm glad now that we just talk about it, and it's not happening. And I guess if it ever happened again, we'd know what to do.
That's good. Thank you, Helen. Helen does bring up a really important part of the story, that while we were in Haiti, while we were in jail, on the day of our arrest, there were three other people from our church four others from our area that were in the Dominican Republic working to prepare the house that we were, or the hotel that we were renovating to be a temporary orphanage or children's home. And they were instructed the day we were arrested, you need to get on a plane and go home immediately. So they did. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Do you remember where you were? What was going on?
I was a junior in college, and I think I had been maybe at a basketball game, I don't know, and a friend of mine who also lived in Twin Falls, she was friends with, she also knew the other group of people that had went after you guys, and she came and found me and told me that what she had heard was that they had been arrested, and or something like that. The details were a little sketchy, so she wasn't quite sure exactly what was going on. But all I knew was we had friends over there, and we didn't have all the details, and we just, I don't know, started praying. And I just remember that the whole time that they were over there in jail, it was kind of a lonely time for me because... I feel like I was the only people who cared that they were in jail. And I would watch the news every night. And I remember people telling me, well, why are you watching the news? Like, you don't need to watch the news. I don't know. It was just, like, I just felt like I need to know this. And I was worried and, like, I don't know. And the whole time I knew God was in control, but there was still a lot of unknowns. And... so, anyways, I was at school.
That's great. Thank you, Bianca. We knew Bianca here in the church because this is where she would come in the summertime during her college years, and she worked at what was then the Sonic on this side of town. Some of you don't know there used to be a Sonic over here. But that's she lived with the Steinekes during the summertime, and then would go back to school. So we've had a long connection with Bianca. Well, thank you, Steve. Steve's going to help you.
I can well remember that it was a Saturday because I was working my nursing shift at the Craig, and it was in the afternoon, and Clyde, my husband, Paul's father, came up to the Craig, and he pulls me aside, and he said that they'd been arrested. And, of course, I was very shocked, fearful. I didn't know exactly how to register all that. Are you sure? You know? And so I quickly finished my shift and got someone else to work for me the next day. And Clyde and I went over to my brother's house, Bud and his wife Phyllis, who were the parents of Jim Allen. And we tried together to learn what was going on, what could we believe. And I know we prayed. Physical support was very important. And then we also called our families. We had to let Paul's brothers know. And our extended families. But it was a shock. We were stunned.
Thank you, Mom. So while Allie's coming up, right after we were released, the first place I wanted to go was Omaha to see David. And the very next place, we got to get to Amarillo. I need to see my mom and dad.
We didn't know each other when this happened. I was in Glens Ferry, and my pastor was Don Woody, and I worked with Rachel Woody at the elementary school. And I remember her telling me about what happened, and that they had an opportunity to go with you all, and that they decided not to. I remember praying with her there in our special ed room where we worked, and remember praying as a church. I did a paper route in the middle of the night, and I remember being awake and watching TV when some of you came home. I can't remember exactly who came home, but it was on the television. So I enjoy remembering that, remembering praying for you all, not knowing someday you'd be my pastor and my friends.
Amen. Thank you, Allie. Your pastor at that time was in still pastors in the region. Don Woody is a dear friend, and I'm grateful to hear that. Who would have known? I had good conversations with Don about the very high likelihood of him coming with us during those days. And didn't work out. Anyone else? All right. Silas, where were you the day we were arrested? Steve?
I know.
I wonder if you might need to get closer to those microphones. Adjust them as you need to. Just because, you can even take them out of the stand if you want. Let's talk about the day of the arrest briefly, and then let's turn the clock backwards and think through what led up to the day of arrest. But Silas, what was going through your mind while in process of being arrested?
Well, the process of the arrest wasn't really anything like, you can't really equate it to being arrested in the United States, what you would think of as being arrested. I don't know how to make this word. There we go. I can't even recollect the exact moment that we were arrested. There was this entire span of the evening that we arrived at the border, and then there's all kinds of very sketchy stuff that goes on with the border guard, and then the next morning, like most arrested people, we drive ourselves back into the town with a bunch of children in our vehicle. That's very unlike a legitimate arrest in that sense. So I don't know, are we arrested at the point when I'm taking my belt off and they're taking everything out of my pockets and we go into the jail? Or are we arrested that morning? I never I think just maybe we were arrested that day is all that I could ever really come to, because there's language stuff going on as well. The day is, you know, real bizarre, just between all of the language issues and the kind of just the unbelievable reality of it. I don't think it was that day that the gravity of our arrest hit me. Just because of the, you know, if they had shown up with sirens and put us all in handcuffs and it had been anything like you might imagine an arrest to be, it might have sat very differently on my mind. But so that's sort of what I remember of the actual arresting, is us being in, still being in charge of a busload of children, it was just a very, very bizarre day.
Yeah, that's a good word to use for that day. It was bizarre. Steve, what do you remember about the time, the process? Maybe when are you realizing we're probably not going home today?
Well, to me, it all started that, I think it was a Saturday morning. I don't exactly remember, but it was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and we're all told to get up, and there's these police there, and we were all just so tired because we hadn't slept for two nights, and it was like hard, and we finally got the kids to sleep, and it was like really, really late that night, and I just zonked out, and man, it was just boom. I was, all of a sudden you wake up and there's these things, you got to get everybody in the bus and you got to get down, we're going to go down and get papers. But it's like, well, this isn't normal. There's this police car and it's the flashing light on the top of this police car and we're following this thing all the way to the police station. And we didn't know it was a police station, except when we got in there, it was like, well, you got to take your stuff in there, and you have all these kids, and you can't leave this building. So I kind of looked at this and said, well, because that was the same place that we had gone to before to get the papers, and they basically told us, well, you don't have the right papers, so why don't you go to the border, and they'll know what papers you need. So it was, I didn't think we were arrested, but I knew there was something going on because they were all talking, and the issues with language, it was very confusing that day.
So it was January 30th, 2010. It was a Saturday. And like these two guys are saying, there's a lot of confusion from our vantage points as Silas is telling you, when we get to the police station, as Steve's expressing to you, we're asked to get the children off of the bus. You know, this is a serious thing. You know, when we think about international trafficking of children, I mean, this is kind of serious. This is a serious issue in the nation of Haiti. I mean, today is the Super Bowl. Surrounding the Super Bowl in the United States of America is some of the worst human trafficking happens surrounding this event that we chose not to go home and watch tonight. So trafficking of children is gigantic, and it is enormous business in the world. It's immoral and God-hating business. But it is a money laundering, money making industry, and so in this encounter that we're having, the international police, the international media, are all present, and no one's removing the children from us. Matter of fact, all the pictures that we have, and next week I'll have some pictures to kind of show you some things. But tonight I just really wanted to set the stage and to tell the story from this vantage point, but you'll see pictures of us both from what were taken from the media's vantage point and from ours. I mean, we had our cell phones all day. We had our cameras all day, and we have pictures of crying children sitting in Steve's lap and Silas surrounded by 6 or 7 3- and 4-year-olds, and we're responsible to take care of these kids. So we don't know that. Matter of fact, we don't know until the following Monday and Tuesday any kind of legitimate or real charges of why we're being detained. We're told that in this judicial system, which is completely the opposite of the blessed judicial system of the United States of America, where you're innocent until it's proven that you're guilty. In a Napoleonic judicial system, you are guilty the moment someone charges you with something, and then you have to prove your innocence. And so in that judicial system designed for corruption, you sit in jail until you either pay your way out or until you prove your innocence. So we are learning the judicial system on the fly. Our first several hours on that Saturday at the Child Protective Services offices, which is also a type of holding jail at the airport in Port-au-Prince, that we eventually are. And I think the formality of it happens, Silas, later when we're told to remove the shoelaces from our shoes and remove our belts. So while that's happening, I'll just share this with you, and then let's turn the clock back and think through a couple of things together. And I have several questions for these guys to see how we express these things today and how we observe them. But as I'm assessing, where is everybody while we're being processed? So we finally, the children have been removed from us, and we are never handcuffed, we're never roughed up, we're never kicked around or pushed around. They just simply instruct us to walk down this hallway, and eventually through a series of corners, and then finally a door being opened, we walk into a room that it's clear this is a jail cell. We're in the outer office of the jail area. And so I'm making an assessment. I'm responsible. Renee's going to want to know, did you know where Silas was all of the time? So I'm looking, checking in, where's he at? And I see him. He's like all of us a bit. We're just doing what we're told to do. And the police officers are telling us through their broken English, everything's okay. This is just a big misunderstanding. You'll be here through the weekend and you'll go home. Of course, we'll be told that 100 times through the next several weeks. I look over and I find Steve. I say, I got to know where Steve's at. Man, I got to answer to my church. Where's Steve at during this? And at this moment is among many, many tender moments on this pastor whenever I observe and watch and look at what's going on with the men on our side of the room or in our side of the cell, that Steve has already pulled out his Gideon Bible, and he's over at the barred doors, and he has about 3 or 4 Haitian men. Their arms are through their side of the bars, and they have their Gideon Creole Bible, and Steve's already got his Bible up, and he's looking through the gospel. He's leading them essentially through verses in John and Romans, if I remember properly, and he reads it in English, and none of them, at least we think none of them, know English. We'll know later that they spoke some form of English. But he reads a line in English, and then he points to the verse in their Creole Bible, and they read it in Creole. And so at that moment, I'm sitting here going, well, a few days of discomfort will be worth opportunities to be on the other side of these bars with these men if God will give us the opportunity to share the gospel with them. It may have been that first night that we were in jail, that Steve makes this comment that, you know, we came here to do a type of children's ministry, but apparently God has jail ministry upon us for the moment. And indeed, we did. We had 17 days of jail ministry in a Haitian jail. Maybe it was 19. I lose count of the days. 19 days. It was the 17th of February when we were released. So it's 19 days total of jail ministry in the Haitian jail. So before I turn the clock back, Silas, would you, if you had, as you observe back over those days, is there any of those days? By the way, these questions are totally extemporaneous to them. I've written a handful of questions down. I haven't shared them with them in advance. I want this to just really be a story from the heart. I want us to just tell it as we remember it today. Is there anything about those days today that you regret in the experience? You should totally speak your mind.
Yeah, I think a lot of the regret that I have related to the ordeal comes when we come home, to my reaction to a lot of what was perceived and perceived in my own mind. That's where a large portion of my regret lies, is in my handling of those days. My essentially closing myself off to pretty much everything. But as far as the imprisoned days, I think sort of what the main regret that I can look back on now is there's kind of one. Essentially, the book of Job becomes the sweetest 42 chapters of all time to me during these days in prison. For some reason, we're allowed to all take our Bibles in. So just over and over this sort of on repeat, just reading through the book of Job. And in the 13th chapter, there's it's verse 15, it's, "Though he slay me, I will hope in him." And this is a great joy that I don't think I ever lost that. But it's this human nature, and it's Job's, the next part of Job's sentence, unfortunately, is was mine as well. It was, "Nevertheless, I will argue my case before him." And so it was these combating, at odds responses to the circumstances. It was, even if, I think the Holman says, "Even if you kill me, I will hope in you." But then at the same moment, I was holding on to this, "But nevertheless, why am I here? Tell me, God, what, let me argue with you why I should not be here. Why I do not deserve this, why we don't deserve to be here, why this wasn't part of our plan." And I think that is probably the largest regret that I have from those days, was that sentiment of still, why am I here? Mm-hmm. And I don't know that, I think that probably leads, you know, in the sovereignty of God is used to break me down and to used to bring me to him closer. That's my answer to that.
Good. Thank you. Steve, what about you? When you reflect back on those days 10 years ago, are any parts of the experience, either then or since then, that you regret?
The only thing I can think of is, because I don't regret anything about being in jail. I thought it was kind of fun. in some ways, it was really hard. But one of the things that I regret, kind of, is I always thought, well, I should have did this. But it was when we were walking down the hallway, and there was a really long hallway, and all of these reporters are in the back of us or something. They're following, I don't remember if they're following us or stuff. And I look around, and there's all these reporters and cameras, and they're all looking at us and taking pictures. And I had a Boise State shirt on, and I almost, you should just say, go Boise State, you know, and I didn't do it. And I kind of went, you should have done it. But as far as
I thought you were going to say you regret having that shirt on.
No, uh-uh. I enjoyed that thing. Actually saved me a lot of mosquito bites. So
yeah. It was a long sleeve.
It was a long sleeve Boise State shirt, and it was warm. Which you didn't need in that place, but
who wears a hoodie in Haiti?
Oh, it was terrible. I saw what those things did to him, and poor old short sleeved and yeah. So
for me, a couple of things I regret. I regret that we didn't think in advance at any level to think we need to pack Creole Bibles with us. You know, as a matter of fact, I even see evidence of it in my journal writings from those days, of how often that would creep upon me while in jail. And again, I think I would agree with Silas and Steve both. The days in jail were filled with gospel opportunities at such a level that the enduring of it, there were times for me that my emotions would kind of come up and down and crash a few times. But largely across the scope, those days in jail were exhilarating, because they were, it was clear, a sovereign God directs our steps. And so we'll trust Him while we're in it.
I think the roller coaster, the lows were the nights. Were the lows. Because during the day, you know, like Steve said, there were even elements of, because there was five of us, you know, and I think it was probably just natural that there was an attempt to lighten things. We would make checkerboards on cardboard, and the Dominican was a really hilarious guy that was in jail with us. But when the night came, and when you were just in your head, and there's these awful cramps in your shoulders because you have nothing but the concrete, and you can try to use your shoes for a pillow, and they stink really bad, and you can use your Bible, which after about 10 minutes, it feels almost harder than the concrete. And then about 4 in the morning, you wake up and realize there's an eternity of night left, and there's things crawling on you and crawling in the corner, and that's when the lows would come.
There were extra sets of eyes some of those nights. the nights were long and hard.
I think there was some sheets and pillows and stuff in there that were available for us. But I wasn't going to touch them.
No, those were just filthy. They'd been there for a long time, and I don't know how they even got there. The Dominican used them to climb up in the for the hammock, and so I always was wondering if they would hold him up there, because we were always underneath him, and I thought, well, he's going to fall down there and kill us.
I have a piece of his window hammock.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's really thin, and he'd climb up there, and sometimes the second guy would climb up there in this hammock that they built.
Yeah. Did you rip that off the hammock?
I did. I hope it still held.
Yeah, I'm really curious. I'm worried for them now. Psalm 37 says this: do not be agitated by evildoers, and do not envy those who do wrong, for they wither quickly like grass and wilt like tender green plants. Trust in the Lord and do what is good. Dwell in the land and live securely. Take delight in the Lord, and He will give you your heart's desire. Commit your ways to the Lord. Trust in Him, and He will act, making your righteousness shine like the dawn, your justice like the noonday. Be silent before the Lord and wait expectantly for Him. Do not be agitated by one who prospers in his way, by the man who carries out evil plans.
Is that Psalm 37?
Psalm 37. So let me just turn the clock back a handful of days. How did we even get involved in this in the first place? At the time, we were pretty active as a church in prayer walking and Bible distribution in the Arabian Peninsula, and I'll just leave it at that. We can talk more specifically about where that is when I'm not online or such. But we were in a closed gospel. We were actively engaged in this multiple times, traveling, making contact with businessmen who were there doing gospel work. And so Steve and I and another gal from the church who since has moved to Texas were in the path of planning a trip to the Arabian Peninsula. And just trouble with passports and trouble with getting everything lined up, which was common. It was a regular experience. It seemed like every time we would go, there would be some kind of a delay somewhere along the way. But this one was perpetual. It just wasn't going to happen. And so we got the word of the earthquake that had taken place in Port-au-Prince. And for me, anyway, it was like, oh, yeah. And the nation of Haiti is still there. As a boy, I remember the hearing about and reading about and seeing the images of the hardship in the country of Haiti. And it just kind of had gone quiet for a couple of decades for us. And then that earthquake, January of 2010, it's like the whole world has woken up again. This little country that's in dire poverty is still here. And so we begin to see images of how devastating the city was. And it was devastated. So we got word from Central Valley Baptist Church in Meridian that they were looking for some individuals who'd be willing to go to Port-au-Prince with them. And so I just began to send the word out. I invited our church family. We began praying about could we, should we, what would it look like if we went? I sent word out to Silas. He was living in Omaha with David at the time. I'd even intentionally made contact with Renee's brother, and through the grapevine had got to my cousin in Amarillo. And the next thing you know, within about I can find the page precisely here, but within about 36 hours of making the announcement that we're going to go ahead and say yes, we're available to go. Within about 36 hours, we have these five individuals who, our schedules were already free because we were planning to be in the Arabian Peninsula starting essentially on these dates. And so time off of work, both I was working bivocational at that time, had already made arrangements to be gone. So it was a natural, it worked. They said, sure, you can feel free to go. And Silas made arrangements with where he was working at in Omaha. Steve, kind of the same situation. He already had some time that he was given time off. And so we committed to go. And by the grace of God, Renee was able to get airline tickets from those of us from Twin Falls and Omaha, Amarillo, and Topeka to all be able to converge in Miami nearly within a few moments of each other, to prepare them to go on into the Dominican Republic, which was where the only place you could get into the island. Haiti was completely shut off. The airport, even at that time, nobody was leaving or coming in. The airport, the runway even had complications of being able to do such a thing. So we arrive in the Dominican Republic. Those from Central Valley Baptist Church in Meridian arrive in the Dominican Republic. That's the first time that we meet them, is actually in the Dominican Republic. I had known some of them from previous partnerships that we have in ministry in the region, but we're for the first time, we kind of really get our marching orders of what's going to happen. The church in Meridian had secured an agreement to rent an old abandoned hotel, and they were going to use it as a temporary housing. This was the common thing that was happening in Haiti. Agencies from all over the world were finding locations in the Dominican Republic, and they were going to move the children across the border. The border was open, largely here between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. It's a very tight border, but because of the humanitarian plight for help, the international borders were open, and so coming back and forth was extremely easy. And all the way even through, even though we had a couple of strange things on our passports, I have more stamps going into Haiti than I have coming out of Haiti. And we went back and forth several times, but when I count them out, maybe I have more coming out of Haiti than I have going in. It's a really messy little situation. And so we spent about 6 days actually in the Dominican Republic, into Haiti, back out, back in, and all of this with established contact with children's homes that the church in Meridian had made contact with and that they needed help with. And so we would go in with supplies of water and nutritious, they called it plumping nut, I think, some kind of peanut butter rich nutritious food. And so we would have that with us. We would make contact with a children's home. We'd get there and the story would be radically different than what we had been communicated about. And so we made the decision ahead of time, during one of our times back into the Dominican Republic, that we're not going to do anything without paperwork. Because, I mean, this is too volatile of a situation. There's too much unknown. We've also made the decision just on our... not that we make a judgment against missionaries who pay bribes, but we made the decision on the front end that we would not pay any undocumented fees. This was how volatile everything was. And so in the conversation between the five of us, and then when we would communicate with Central Valley, it was agreed that we would not pay any undocumented fees because we don't want to have to face any judicial pressure of why are you paying fees that are, or why are you paying bribes? You must be doing something wrong. So our agreement to not pay undocumented fees would prove to be some of our problem. So there again, you have a conversation with missionaries around the world and you'll hear the debate of should you or shouldn't you. And eventually many of them do, just simply because it makes their ministry much easier and less complicated. Do things by the book, you don't get anything done. Or you go to jail. Mm-hmm. If you do it by the book, you'll go to jail. Are you getting ready to say something?
Oh, no.
Okay. Feel free to break in here and correct anything that I'm saying. I don't journal every day of my life, but there are certain stages and certain times in my life when I will. I carry around little notebooks in my back pocket, and I want to write down, you know, some things that I want to remember about the day. I have a shoebox at home packed full of these little booklets. Some of them have a bunch of nonsense in it and numbers, and I record most of the games that I win in them so that I have a record that I've... So they're pretty. Some of it's pretty meaningless, but for whatever reason, John, I don't know if you remember this or not, but you gave this journal to me before we left, and I thought, well, that's a handy little thing. I'll just chart my days and see how it comes back at the end of. I have several of these little books that have about 4 or 5 pages filled up, and the other 100 and so are blank and empty. This one is completely packed full. Began journaling the events of the days. And so many times, I record my prayers many of the times in these. And I'm thinking through things I'm praying for Silas about in the days going back and forth between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. Things I'm praying for Steve about, for his family. praying for Renee and for her brother, praying for my cousin, who's almost the first time in a missionary type of a situation, totally out of his normal experience. He's a business owner, runs things. He's the boss. And so I'm praying for him and looking and seeing how God's working in his life in these early days of a lot of frustration, because we get news that we've now got some children that are prepared and ready. Documents are being filed on the Haitian side and on the Dominican Republic side. And as Steve tells you, as shared with you earlier, we're in this office the day before, and we were in that office the day before that. And each time we're there, they tell us, you got to go to this office on this side of town. And they'll tell us, no, you got to go back to that side of town. Until eventually, at the office where we are eventually detained on that Saturday, we're told, we don't have your documents here that you're needing. They'll have them for you at the border. And so they told us to go to the border. And so we did.
To get across town also... It might not be what you're thinking. Port-au-Prince, to begin with, is a massive city, but because of the earthquake, it was all-day journeys across town with a bus full of children at times, and we're driving buses through the river, because the bridge would be out, and they'd be taking bizarre, routes down to the sides of the river. And then also just unrest throughout, burning everywhere.
Maybe both of you share a little bit of the visual things you would see. Silas, I think that's good. Whenever we'd go into the city, we went in and out twice before the time where we're arrested. But what do you recall about what you saw in the city of Port-au-Prince? Or what do you remember smelling in the city?
The smell was interesting. The one thing that I thought was very interesting was going across the border. When we went in, we'd never been there before. We went in this big Greyhound bus, and the Dominican Republic was just potholes everywhere, and it was slow going all the way across to get to the border, and as soon as the border happened, it was just like desert. It was just barren. I could not believe my eyes. I think when you go from lush green, beautiful birds everywhere, and then there's the border, and then there's just nothing but... the only thing I can think about is like going down to Nevada. It's just barren. No trees, rocks, just nothing. And then going into the city of Port-au-Prince, and it was just like muddy, and in the streets there was no asphalt. It was just big open spaces, and lots of cars, and they were all beat up cars. They're all cars that would you'd take to a derby, one of those derbies that they would crash the cars, and all of them had big dents in them, and they were just everywhere, and everybody drove on any side of the street all the time, and it didn't make sense to me, because we were making good headway, and we were only 10 miles out, and it took us 2 hours to go 10 miles, and so then, same thing. You get in there, and if we'd have been in, I don't know that we'd have been able to even participate in the driving part of it. But the drivers that we had were just wonderful drivers, and they just were very patient. And we got in there, and it was stop here and wait for hours, and stop over there and wait for hours, and talk to these people and talk to those people. And it was just a dreary, hard place to look at, and we didn't really get to get out and talk to them, because we couldn't understand anything anyway. But it was, when we did get out, it was kind of scary. We didn't know what to say to the people, and it was, the smells were not, you're not used to, a lot of urine smells, a lot of feces smells just in the streets. It was just And it's that way all the time. So
to say they were good drivers means that they were able to drive insanely in a Greyhound at times. One thing that visually I can remember really distinctly is, the earthquake was the 10th of January, is that right?
Yeah.
So we're 20, not even 20, 10 days after. And they're still a very, everywhere you go, people are unburying, carrying large concrete chunks. They're looking, people are just weeping, see someone moving stuff and then there's just weeping. They're still finding people. At this point, they're not. No one is being found alive anymore, I imagine. And also, I remember there being the increasing danger of just sort of pop-up checkpoints. Anyone that wanted to set up a checkpoint would just set up a checkpoint, and not with any government authority, but just with the authority that they were the most powerful or they had the most guns at that moment. It was a pretty... our drivers all spoke Spanish. Everyone in Haiti spoke Creole or French. We all spoke English, and I had the great luxury of a high school Spanish.
He was our translator.
There was a great deal of strangeness to the fact that I was 6 years in a Spanish class. It does not prepare you for earthquake ravaged driving insanity and giving directions. But I do. There was just a visually sense of despair just across the land. From the border, like Steve said, just a ravaged landscape. From that moment to, the center of the town, there's nothing beautiful in that moment. Maybe a month before there's children running, there's beautiful elements, but in this time, it's just the visual despair matches the despair of the people.
There is an occasion on our first trip in that we've gone from one location to another, to another, to another. And eventually we end up just outside of the Dominican Republic embassy in the city of Port-au-Prince. And there the duty at that point is to find out then are there any other things that we need to know to be able to do this ministry that the church in Meridian had felt compelled to be a part of. And while we're there, this is the place where we actually bring some children onto the bus. And we've gone into a tent city, which is actually just in the courtyard of a giant church. They basically have turned the inside of the courtyard of the church, a giant, massive area, and they've converted it into a tent city. You could still go there today and still see people living in some of these tent cities. But it's here where the pastor, we have conversation with him, and they've located, I have it written down here, that there were seven children that had unaccounted parents. They didn't know who their parents were. And so the community inside this tent city was just taking care of them. And he had asked if we could take care of them for them. And so while we're still trying to get some clarity on from the Dominican Republic side of things, even though the border is open, getting clarity on what needs to be done, the pastor brings those children to us on the bus, and by the providential hand of God, a Haitian police officer actually gets on the bus, has conversation with it. He's speaking some pretty good English and is learning what we're doing, and he says, listen, I'm grateful that you're here. Here are some things that I want to recommend that you do. First, go ahead and put the children back into this tent city. And then in your pursuit of these documents, keep in that pursuit and know that everything you're doing is the right way to do it. Document, document, documentation, documentation, documentation. Now, let's also remember this. Most of the documentation, legal documentation in Haiti, is in a spiral notebook and in pencil. And so when we eventually go back on the second trip into the city, and we are working with a ministry called Children Sharing Jesus Ministries, the registrar from that place is in a spiral notebook and names and birth dates of children and any known living relatives charted out on this sheet. And all of the children that they transfer into our care, they put a line through their document and we register it on our document, the same information. So that's how the transfer of the documentation is handled. And it's the official documentation. He signs the document. So now we have the registry now to take into the official offices to work through the process then. Here's where the children came from. Here's a list and any phone numbers perhaps there might be or contact information about it, the nearest living relatives of the children. So that's the official documentations that we're working with. And we're learning on the fly of this that this is the way it's done. It's not the way anyone in this country would think that's the way it should be done, but that's the way it's done there.
On the tent cities, when we went into there, there was a gentleman, because we kind of got split up. There was a group that was around Laura and Pastor Paul, and I don't know what was happening with Silas, but there
don't,
was a...
Don't
a,
say you don't know what was going on with Silas.
Okay, yeah, well, he was close to me then. But there was a group of people there, and we were telling them what we were doing, and there's a man that was there who spoke very good English, and he was translating for me, and so then he was telling everybody what I was talking. You know, we have this orphanage we are starting, and we were looking for kids to take to this orphanage, and there was this grandma there who was little short lady, and she was just begging me to take her grandchildren, and all of her children had been killed, and in this earthquake, and in the process she had three children that were sitting there about 3, 5, and 7 years old, and they just looked beat up. I mean, it was just I just felt really sad for them, but she was begging me to take these children because they were in the process of, and the man told me, says, if you don't take these, they're going to die. And I'm going, if they were my kids, I would make sure that they were in a hospital because they didn't look good. Their eyes were all bloodshot, and it was just like, my goodness, these kids are in really hard conditions. And in the process, this guy was saying, not only will they die, they might, because the food, there's a lot of problems with having enough food. And it was like, if you don't do something to these kids, they're going to die. And it may not be from accidents. It was almost an intentional thing of these people who were trying to take their food. And I'm going, no, you can't be telling me this. This is hard to deal with. And also in the tent cities, you could buy little girls for $50. And it was, they're yours. You can do whatever you want with them. And that just shocked me terribly. And here's some people. You can take them.
Yeah.
And I'm going, this is not a good place for me. This is a hard place for thinking that way. It opened my mind and my thoughts to a lot of really hard things.
It exposes the kind of despair, I mm-hmm. think, Steve, whenever I think about, especially when we're inside the tent city and we're seeing perhaps firsthand, better than anywhere else we had been, the level of despair, the hunger, the thirst was that ravenous. And Even individuals, grown adults, saying, take me, don't take our children. Because if I go with you, I'm going to get to eat. I'm going to get to drink. And so that's the kind of despair that the situation was in. And I'm not going to stand here and say that I wouldn't do that in that kind of a situation, because I don't know that level of despair. But that's how devastated the city was. I've never been in a war zone. But every book I've read about what it's like in a war zone, I'm thinking it looks exactly like the city of Port-au-Prince after that earthquake. Despair everywhere. I've gone longer than 45 minutes. I'm going to say that's Steve and Silas's fault. It's really not. It's mostly my fault. Can I read a segment out of my journal? This would be January 28th. Any of you are welcome to stick around tonight. We've had a big weekend around here. We got lots of food. So you're welcome. We need to eat this food. We live in a blessed land. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. This is January 28th, 2010. So some of it's going to come with information I haven't brought you up to speed in. So you'll just have to fill in some of the blanks. But we've contacted Pastor Jean. He's the pastor of the Haiti Sharing Jesus Ministries. And we've lined up with our three interpreters, Isaac, Steve, and Stephen. And we're still working to finalize the documentations. The process seems difficult to understand, and the situations change. The process, after clarity has been given, then it changes even again. So we've been told that the illegal trafficking of children has increased, and the need to have documentation from the director of the orphanage or the children's home is of the greatest importance. And we are in agreement with this. And now we press on to give hope from God to the children. We have gathered, so at this point, from Haiti Sharing Jesus Ministries, from two locations in the city of Port-au-Prince, they've transferred 33 children into our care. So maybe just to say this in respect of this. Our first trip into the city, we had this luxury Greyhound touring bus from the Dominican Republic. It was really sweet, man. I'd travel anywhere. It wasn't the best. But
going across a river in that thing, it was not good. And I was translating. It was not good.
The second time in, because we learned a lot the first time in, that the big cruise liner bus was not the right bus to have. So we had a small bus, about a 16 or 18 passenger bus. And we have 33 children. We learned that's pretty normal. They seem very comfortable in this little bus. So 33 children that we've received from Haiti Sharing Jesus Ministries. Let me make one more parenthetical statement here. This is the day we met Alex Viard, January 28th, 2010. While we are outside of the children's home from Pastor Jean of Haiti Sharing Jesus Ministries, Alex comes walking down the street and strikes up a conversation with me and asks if I could come up to his house, which is, I learned later, would be his parents' house. And he says, we have some children that we don't know where the parents... This is nearly everywhere we go, people have gathered children and nobody knows where their parents are at. So I walk up there with him and a gentleman by the name of Junior, who also we have a long friendship with, and a woman by the name of Florence. So I walk up to Alex's house at that point, and sure enough, there's these children that his mom is taking care of. And they just ask straight up, can you take these children? We can't feed them here any longer. And I remember, for me, one of the hardest things to say was, we cannot take these children because we're only authorized to work with the children's homes and the registrations from their care into our care. So we exchange phone numbers. And I assure Alex that as we learn more and as we can determine how best to help in the situation, that we'll be in touch and we'll have people that will be coming back and forth and we'll make sure that you've got food and care for the children. So we exchange phone numbers. really never expecting to ever see Alex ever again, and really for that matter to even talk to him ever again. I go back to the bus where we're now, where there's 33 children in our care. And I think really at this point we have two small buses, but eventually there's, I don't know the disagreement between the bus drivers, but they had a disagreement and one of them left.
I think it was union.
It could have been the union issue. I don't know.
It might have been the translation.
It could have been the translator. But one of the buses left, and so we have 33 children in this small bus, and that's our form of transportation for the next 2 days. And so the traffic is slow, as you've heard these guys say, as it has been every day, so we will not risk going to the border tonight. That's January 28th. Our hope is a safe place to park the bus and to have children examined by medical personnel. That hope has fallen through. There's so much to fill in the blanks. There was an organization that we had spent one night in that was kind of a headquarter for medical agencies from all over the world that were there. It was a Christian school. And so we had made arrangements to take the children back there that night. And when we got there, they refused to let us bring the children in. And I don't fault them because I don't really know why they ultimately forbid us from coming in. But I'm sure they were running low on supplies and food and everything else. And it was just, we can't do any more. And so we're forced to sleep on the streets. We do decide to stay nearby this school because we feel like that's probably the safest place in the city.
The army was in there.
They were. We wanted to stay close to the guys with the guns.
The right guys with the guns.
The right guys with the guns. This is true. So we sleep on the streets of Port-au-Prince, and we do so with joy to care for the children. As we are preparing to bed down the children, they've all been fed well today, and there's plenty of water for the children. It has been a hard day, but a blessed day. I assume that the hardship is over, but the joy is to and from the Lord. The street we slept on, as you heard from Steve and Silas, smelled like urine and human feces, filled with trash, and the nonstop barking of dogs and
chickens.
The crowing
rooster, the rooster. Yeah.
The clucking of chickens all night long. They've been announcing their prayer presence most of the night. And we've been approached. We were not approached by anyone on the street until about 3 a.m. A police officer actually pulled up to the street. They asked if we were all right. We explained what we were doing and why we were on the street. And they were understandable. They they let us remain with no problems. So by the grace of God, we had been checked in on, and it appeared everything was safe and good. January 29th, because the night on the street the previous night was so unrestful and uncomfortable, we're mostly awake by 5:30, probably even earlier than that. The children awake hungry and thirsty, and praise be to God, we have nourishment and plenty of water. We have need to finish the paperwork at the Dominican Republic consulate and at the embassy before moving toward the border. And then you've heard, as we've shared back and forth of these offices, before eventually told to go on to the border. So the day grows long as we continue waiting for the agency to get from one agency to the next. And we have our letter from the pastor, the documentation from his children's home, and the registration from the Dominican Republic they are supposed to be for us waiting at the border. And attempts at Haiti agencies are difficult at best. We have been to Child Services only to be sent to another office that says there is no one here that can answer your questions. And so we're told from that letter and the registration from the pastor, it will be sufficient. And as the day is growing long, we feel the urge to press on. And so we make way to the border, and then there we are, caught up from the time. Now, there's a lot of other details that could be filled in at another time. And the story, discloses the providential hand of God frequently in the process.
Well, there was one thing at the border that to me was very important. Because we were all hungry and we hadn't eaten all day, and we got to the border and it was late, and we sat around with some of the guards, and the guards were asking us questions. And in the process, Paul leads this one of the guards to the Lord. It was just like, wow, this is just for that. It was a well worth it for me. It was this man wanted to know about Christ. And in the process, he asked Christ into his heart right before all of us. And it was just, thank you, Lord. That's what we're here for. So to me, that was important.
Yeah, and Steve, as I recall that encounter as well, it's while it's happening, I'm seeing the evidences of the way the Spirit of God moves in people's hearts, like when we read the book of Acts. And this is how this happened. His name is Snyder. I'll never forget his name. We had been given some MREs to cook for ourselves. We've been feeding the children. We made the decision we wouldn't eat until we got to the hotel back in the Dominican Republic, that we would reserve the food for the children. We weren't eating, but a medical team had given us a box of MREs, and so while at the border, we ate like kings that night. I don't know. We have a lot of other MRE stories to tell you on the jail side of it. Remember how good that macaroni and cheese was? Really liked the macaroni and cheese. You'll have to come back to hear why the macaroni and cheese was so good. But while we're cooking those and these kind of broken English conversations are going on, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, Paul, stay focused on the gospel. These are gospel opportunities. Don't live in regret of not sharing the gospel with anyone. And Snyder essentially comes up to me and he gets a little bit of the story of what we're doing. Come to find out, he grew up in a Baptist children's home in Haiti. And so he was real sympathetic and grateful for what we were doing. And he just straight up asked me, what must I do to become a Christian? And so I'm thinking, and I haven't even told you anything about the gospel yet. Let me tell you about the gospel. And while I'm doing it, I'm hearing the Holy Spirit in my I'm not hearing audible voices, so don't think strange of that. But I'm basically saying, Paul, why are you doing this? I've just brought this guy to you and he's asked you, what must I do to be saved? Why do you need to go back to some kind of a mechanical answer to everything? Just tell him how to be saved. And so that's about what I did. And he prayed and repented and we rejoiced and celebrated with him, which again will land on me. What I shared earlier, some of my greatest regrets. I didn't have a Bible to give him at that moment because we didn't plan that. So, by the grace of God, we have no way of knowing where Snyder's at today and anything about him, but we bless the Lord for that encounter that we had that day. So, I've way gone past 45 minutes, but that's where we're at. Okay, next Sunday night, we want to talk mostly about the days in jail and the stories, the encounters, how the desperate condition we were in and the stories that you were hearing of the news and what we were being told and how we see the hand of God work through incredibly amazing days. I'll just leave it at this. We'll pray. And we'll go. But know that through that first weekend, we had no charges levied against us. Our first day to court, we were charged with, I don't remember what the first charge was, from the voodoo priest, who's the judge. He charges us with... yes, thank you. We're charged with kidnapping. We go back to jail. We're told, you'll go tomorrow. It'll all be cleared up. It's a big misunderstanding. We go back to court the second day, and we're charged with trafficking children. So we have a new lawyer, by the way, because we fired the first one that got us kidnapping charges. And then The second one got us trafficking charges. We fired him. The third judge, or the third lawyer, when we go home from that case, we're charged with criminal association because he's wanted by Interpol for trafficking children. So it's a mess. Mess after mess after mess. While at the same time, we're seeing the unfolding of God's providential hand in our lives. So, and I could just go on and on.